You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Some years ago, while I was working at the intersection of mental health and criminal justice and trying to develop diversion programs for people with mental illness from the criminal justice system, mental health courts started popping up, and they were based very much on the drug courts model. And I will admit that I was one of those people that initially thought this was a good idea. So, you know, we have this over-punitive approach, we have over-incarceration, and the idea that you get to divert people into treatment just sounded, well, much better than what we had, essentially. So I started doing evaluations of mental health courts, just seeing how they operate, going to different towns from very big cities like here in New York to very small places like Idaho Falls, Idaho, and Albany, Georgia. And I found myself in all these places looking at all these different ways in which these mental health courts operate. And there isn't really one model, there's many different models, but all of them have certain basic problems. And the more I saw them, the less comfortable I was with the idea of mental health courts and of specialty courts a little bit more generally. So part of what I saw was that there were a lot of people there in drug courts specifically who didn't seem to need treatment. They were just caught with drugs, but they didn't really need treatment, and they knew suddenly were in a mental health court, in a drug court, getting treatment. The other problem that I saw is that there were a lot of diverting of local resources. So in a place where you used to be able to find a spot, perhaps with a small waiting list on a drug treatment program, suddenly all of the spots in the drug treatment program were taken up by the drug court, and unless you got arrested, there was no way of accessing that treatment. The other problem was the whole widening the net. Things that used to be dealt with as an infraction or that maybe would have probation suddenly required you to attend treatment for a year, and you were just caught in this cycle of violating the terms and then having to go back to prison. And finally, it just became clear that it wasn't really an alternative to prison, because a lot of the sanctions for not doing well in the program was that you went to prison. So I became uncomfortable with that, and I moved away from doing that kind of work and came here to OSF, and I started seeing internationally these drug courts popping up in many different countries. In Chile, you have a system where they can't really, drugs are not criminalized, so technically you're not supposed to be in the court system if you're caught with drugs, but because they have a drug court, they kind of, there's this moral coercion to get you to agree to be in court, even though technically, under the law, you don't have to be in court. In Mexico, a lot of these just deal with alcoholism rather than with actual drugs, but they call them drug courts. So there's a lot of issues around that. And what started bothering me about the internationalization of this movement is that there was no context. There was no context of how these courts came to be in the US, and there was no local context in how they were being applied. So again, the drug courts might look better than what we have if you're dealing in an over-punitive approach with a lot of extra incarceration, but not so much in another country. In Mexico, there is a national healthcare system, and in theory, you should be able to access treatment without having to go through the courts. So why is treatment being tracked through the courts? But there's no question around it, because again, there's no context. Finally, last year, I was at the Commission on Narcotic Drugs, and I hear somebody say, very vigorously promoting with the government of Canada, drug courts, every country should have a drug court, and they say, well, you know, in the US, we no longer arrest people just for using. That doesn't happen in the US. And it just took my breath away, because you can give the charitable assumption for people who believe that this is okay, but then when you hear that, and it is just so patently untrue, then you realize that we have a problem, and we have a PR issue, and we really need to get out there with some evidence of what the other side of the coin is. So at least people can make an informed choice when they are deciding to choose these things. So this panel is an attempt to do just that, trying to highlight the other side of the coin. Why is the evidence around drug courts not as steady as people think it is? Why they're kind of, so we call the drug courts equivocal evidence on a popular intervention, the brief that we put together. The author, Joanne, is right here if you want to talk to her about it. And I'm hoping that you also get to speak to some of these panelists about their experience. I'm going to present them very briefly, and then we're going to start with a short intervention. They are then going to perhaps react to what each other is saying, and then we're going to open it up for you guys to ask some questions. Jason Cherkis is a national investigative reporter for the Huffington Post. He previously worked as a crime reporter for 14 years at Washington City Paper, where he was a two-time Livingston Awards and Young Journalist finalist, and received multiple awards from the Association of Alternative News weeklies. Jason has written a number of stories about drug treatment, and in particular about court-mandated drug treatment. Notable among these was the heartbreaking piece, Dying to be Free, that recounts the overdose death of Patrick Kagi in the context of Kentucky's drug court policies. So I'm going to start with Jason.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about the recent story that I did about drug treatment in the U.S. and more specifically in Kentucky and sort of what I found. Specifically when it relates to drug treatment and drug courts, what was shocking to me when I interviewed people in Kentucky, especially I focused on three counties that were the hardest hit. These are the counties that had higher rates of overdose deaths than any other place in the state and for most of the country. Kentucky is one of the hardest hit in terms of the opiate addiction, pills, and so many of the addicts had made the transition from pills to heroin. And in Northern Kentucky, they were really, really, really hit hard. And I interviewed several, I think three of the judges from drug court there, and I never got a sense from them that they understood the differences between an opiate addiction and, say, an addiction to alcohol or to cocaine. They all had a one-stop solution for all of their defendants. No matter what addiction they came in, they were going to get a 12-step, they were going to get an abstinence-based treatment program. They forced people off of methadone and would force people off of Suboxone. And so if somebody was doing well on these medications and they got a charge, could be anything, they got a charge and they ended up in their courtroom, they'd be forced to taper off or to just get off the medication. And that, I thought that was just these three ornery judges, but that's actually the entire policy for the state. It's just their policy that they don't allow the medically assisted treatments. As I interviewed other judges and other officials around the state, they were adamant that you were really either masking the addiction or you were treating one drug with another drug, the usual stereotypes. None of the judges that I interviewed seemed like they had consulted a doctor. A lot of it was just who the most well-known treatment official was in their county. And for most part, that's going to be somebody in the AA or 12-step community, because it's the dominant form of treatment. So that's sort of one of the shocking things that I found, was just sort of the judges were forcing addicts to not take methadone or Suboxone, even if they were doing well on the medications, and their limited knowledge base. And I felt that that had an effect on the defense attorneys who were representing these clients, that they were so fatigued by what the judges were doing that they never really challenged it. They never thought it was worth challenging the judges. And so routinely they would, you know, they would plead their defendants to maybe methods that they didn't agree with, forced into to attend NA or AA meetings, and forced off methadone. There was one case of a defense attorney who told me that her client was forced off methadone, and shortly after he was forced off it, he committed suicide because he knew that he wouldn't be able to handle his addiction without the methadone, and so he killed himself. And afterwards, the prosecutor emailed the defense attorney, and the prosecutor said, "It's all your fault. You know, you did this to him." And I don't understand why he blamed the defense attorney, but that's what he did. And there's this sort of, you kind of get a sense of the sort of mean-spiritedness of some of these places. The other thing, two other points I'll make is just that I have found, I studied all 93 overdose cases in northern Kentucky, and what was shocking to me was so many of them had spent the last moments or last months of their life adjudicating a previous overdose where they had survived. They would, after they overdosed, the police would then come back and then charge them with a drug paraphernalia charge or, you know, something to that effect, and then they would spend the rest of their year in the courtroom, either on probation or going in and out of jail or, you know, just this litany of little court appearances, and it happened so many times. And not once did a doctor, either at the ER where they were treated or the emergency, you know, the paramedics or a judge ever said to them, you know, let's figure out what the best treatment is for you, and let's look at your treatment history, your addiction history, your life, and see where the treatment would work best for you. Instead, they were just sort of funneled all into the same program. And the other thing I'll just mention briefly is just that for so many parents in Kentucky and probably a lot of other places where opioid addiction is sort of booming, they don't know where to turn. And many parents in Kentucky, they have a law where you can turn your child in. They call it Casey's Law. It's named after a child that overdosed and died. And so that parents could just turn their kid into the courts, and when the judge, it guaranteed their son or daughter, loved one, access to treatment. And they just thought that was the surest way to get treatment was through the court. Everywhere they turned, there was a waiting list. It was, it was too much money. They knew that the courts would at least guarantee that their son or daughter some kind of treatment. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, you know, you had brought up this constant sort of adjudication or this, hey, we don't prosecute users. We may be leaning against the sort of mandatory minimum of like 20 years or these exorbitant sentence that we have all are outraged by. But in a sense, we've just replaced it with, like, instead of 20 years, it's 10 years of in and out of the court system. It's tied to your drug testing. You got to pee in a cup every 2 days or every week. And then you got to, if you violate your probation in any kind of way, you're back in jail. And I've seen that happen over and over again in cases. So that's what I'm saying. Mm-hmm.
So next we're going to have Rick Jones, who's the executive director and a founding member of the Neighborhood Defender Service of Harlem, and he's also a lecturer at Columbia Law School, where he teaches criminal defense externships and a trial practice course. He's frequently invited to lecture on criminal justice issues throughout the country and has co-chaired a number of task forces, including the Special Task Force on Problem-Solving Courts. So Rick, how does this track with your experiences?
Well, let me say a couple of things, and I really do apologize that I have to leave in an hour.
Would you mind turning your microphone
around? Oh, sure, certainly. Sorry. Is that better?
Yes.
Is that better? All right. So I'll apologize again. I have to leave in an hour, and I apologize. I apologize for that. And I will tell you that prior to my sort of exploration of problem-solving courts and drug courts around the country, I had never practiced in a drug court or any sort of problem-solving court. I had been a trial lawyer for 15 years or so, and at the time when I was invited and asked, really, to go on this sort of listening tour around the country, I was trying murder cases and really hadn't given much thought to issues of substance abuse or drug courts at all. I was much more worried about people not spending the rest of their life in prison than I was about drug courts. But in 2007, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers put together convened a task force to look at this question of specialty courts and problem-solving courts and drug courts, and because they were sort of this burgeoning, you know, cottage industry in the criminal justice system, what were they, why did they exist, and were they a net good, a net bad? What was the sort of verdict on these courts? And the task force was convened. We did hearings around the country in seven different cities. We started in Miami, which is where the first drug courts were really sort of founded in this country. And we went to San Francisco and Tucson, held hearings here in New York, Milwaukee, Austin, Texas, and D.C. We heard from more than 130 witnesses, and there is about 3,000 pages of testimony that was amassed in the course of our travels and all of that. And we produced a report, which came out in 2009, and it's amazing to me that it's been that long. And I was hoping to bring copies of that report because we had thousands of them at one time, and then we went to look for them. Today, where there are none, but you can find them if you want at www.nacdl.org/drug courts. You can find the report there and the transcripts and the testimony, the hearings, and all that stuff. There's a wealth of material that you can access. And so there's two interesting questions here, right? The first is the efficacy of drug courts and whether or not they should exist, and then there's this secondary question of exporting them around the world, right? And I will say two things sort of quickly about both of those questions. And the first is that I think the overarching takeaway from our study of drug courts and from our work at these hearings was that so much, and I'm sure that I'm, to some degree, greater or lesser degree, I don't know exactly who this audience is, but a bunch of smart folks who think about this stuff. And to the extent that you're smart folks and you think about this stuff, and I see a good friend in the back, Lenny Noisette, you understand that at almost every step in along the way, our criminal justice system is broken, and not only is it broken, but it's racially disparate. It unfairly impacts the poor, and so drug courts are merely sort of a manifestation of that, right? The overarching sort of principle that we walked away with from our inquiry into these courts is that this is really a public health issue, that this is not an issue that should be in the legal system at all. Were there resources in the communities, were there public health resources that people could access, then we could more effectively use our criminal justice system for other things and not be spending huge amounts of resources on drug courts and other problem-solving courts, and dumping all of society's sort of problems at the doorstep of the criminal justice system, where they don't belong and where they're not most effectively treated. So that was sort of the major takeaway. To the extent that we realize that drug courts are prevalent in the American criminal justice system, we made a handful of recommendations, and I will run through them very, very quickly because I'd much rather answer your questions and have time to have the other folks on the panel talk. The first is that you shouldn't have to plead guilty to get treatment. Most of the courts that we found around the country were pre-plea courts, which means that you had to have been arrested and you had to plead guilty to get access to the treatment. And we felt like that was obviously not the way it should be. Also, that your case, once you successfully gone through the drug court program, however long that might be, 6, 12, 18, 24, 36 months, the case ought be dismissed. And in many cases, we found that was not the case either, because lots of times people don't succeed all the way to the end of the drug court, and when you fail, the penalty is often much harsher and more severe for having tried and failed than had you never gone into drug court in the first place. The other recommendation that we're making based on what we found is that in many places across the country, prosecutors are the gatekeepers. Prosecutors are the ones who decide who gets in and who doesn't into drug court, and that has all kinds of problems in terms of fairness, in terms of transparency, in terms of whether or not, what the objectives of drug court are. Many times prosecutors are much more concerned about success rates than they are about individuals, because success rates oftentimes are dovetailed or tied directly to funding. And so to the extent you can say that my drug court has a 95% success rate, that's much more likely to be thought of as a success, and the funding follows, as opposed to we were in Miami, and one of the founders of drug courts, of the drug court phenomenon, said that he had distanced himself and walked away from drug courts because of that very fact, that really the folks who ought to be in drug courts are not nonviolent first-time offenders who who are likely never going to be back in the criminal justice system again, likely have all kinds of supports in terms of parents and teachers and counselors and coaches, and aren't really addicted to anything anyway, so don't really need to be in drug courts. But the folks who really need them, people who have an addiction, people who have a record or prior felony convictions, people who have violence in their background, the people who really need drug courts are precluded from getting them. And so we're misusing those resources. And one of the guys who was in on the ground floor of this said that really what we ought to be saying is that if you're taking those folks and you have a 5, 10, 15% success rate, all hail, because those are the folks you really need to be taking. If you have a 95% success rate in your drug court, it only means that you're taking the wrong people and you're not really doing anything. And then the last thing I'll say, and then I'll be quiet, was that we found that there was a need. And in lots of places, what we found was that to the extent that you really, if you go into local courthouses around the country, you really don't see very many white folks who are defendants. But to the extent that you do, you find them in these specialty courts. You find them in drug court or mental health court or gun court or whatever it is, and they're sort of siphoned off of the regular system, and they're put into these specialty courts, and black and brown and poor and immigrant folks are not. And one of the things that we found that was really troubling, particularly with respect to the immigrant community, was that they were effectively barred from drug court, because merely the fact that you were arrested and pled guilty, even if that plea were ultimately going to be set aside, and even if that conviction were ultimately going to be dismissed, the fact that on the front end you pled guilty was a bar to you from participating in drug court, because it meant that you were likely to be deported anyway during the process. So there was a real bar to the non-citizen community in these courts, and we found that there needs to be much more objective, fair, transparent standards on the front end with respect to all folks. So I'll stop there and invite any questions that you might have later.
Thank you, Reed. So now we're going to hear from Jim Parsons, who's the Vice President and Research Director of the Bureau Institute of Justice, where he shapes the research agenda and works with practitioners, government officials, and partner institutions to implement research findings. His work has included an evaluation of the implementation and impacts of drug law reforms in New York City, and he's going to tell us a little bit about those drug law reforms and around drug court specifically.
Thanks, Denise. Hi, everyone. So, as Denise mentioned, I work at a nonprofit in New York City called the Bureau Institute of Justice. I'd like to talk a little bit about some work that we did looking at the changes to the New York State drug laws, changes that came into effect in 2009, which were hard fought and hard won in terms of addressing an extremely punitive system of sentencing, which came into effect in the early 70s. I should mention that there's some researchers, drug law research is what they do. That's not me. I'm a researcher who's interested in the overlap between public health and the criminal justice system. We are interested in the changes in New York State because we wanted to know what happens when you try and change drug laws in a large city, and drug laws which have become emblematic of the extremely punitive approach to drug use, which has, of course, since the Rockefeller drug laws were implemented in the early 70s, has swept across the country. It's important to note when I go through some of these findings that this isn't meant to be representative of drug courts around the country. This is the experience of New York. I'll talk a little bit about, I think most of you are probably very familiar with the Rockefeller drug laws. I just wanted a couple of facts which just really exemplify how punitive they were. As you know, when they were signed into being in the early 70s, if you're arrested with 4 ounces of a range of different drugs, you were facing a minimum sentence of 15 years and a maximum of life imprisonment. Following the implementation of the Rockefeller drug laws, the number of people in New York State prison who were held for drug offenses increased by a factor of 15. So in 1973, there were just about 1,500 people. By 1999, there were more than 22,000 people in New York State prisons for drug offences. So, and I'll return to this, because thinking about the way that the Rockefeller drug law reforms were implemented, it's important to note the context in which they were implemented, the political context, the social context. Also, the Rockefeller drug laws are widely criticized for their racially disparate impact. My co-investigator on this study, Ernie Drucker, in a paper published 10 or so years ago, calculated that for every white person, every white male between the ages of 21 and 44 held in New York State prison for a drug offense, there were 40 African Americans in the same age range. So this is, you know, provides some context of the extremely punitive and dysfunctional state of New York's drug laws prior to 2009. So we got funding to answer three basic questions. When the laws changed, what happened? What did it mean in terms of recidivism for people who got treatment? And what did it mean in terms of costs? And I'll go over these very quickly. I won't talk about methods too much, but basically what we did was we took people from before who were arrested on drug felony offences before the laws changed, matched them with people post after the law changed, and then tracked outcomes of both of those groups. So we were trying to compare apples to apples. There are some methodological issues which I can talk about the way we did that, and some of these challenges are common to many studies of drug courts. So just quickly to go through some of the findings, we found that of people who were diverted to drug court, the laws led to a 35% increase in the rate of diversion to treatment for people passing through the courts. However, only one in five people who were eligible on paper for treatment actually were diverted to treatment via the drug courts. And of those people who were eligible, about roughly equal percentages went to treatment, received a jail sentence, or received a prison sentence. So this movement, which is supposed to be this panacea for reforming the New York City court system, didn't have that kind of sea change kind of impact that people who pushed for these changes hoped for. Also, we found there was, as I mentioned before, huge racial disparity. We found before the laws changed, if you were African American or Latino facing a drug felony charge, you were three times as likely to go to prison in New York City than if you were white. After the laws changed, the racial disparity reduced, but still you were twice as likely to go to prison if you were a person of color compared to if you were a white defendant. And we found that for people who went to treatment, there was a reduction in recidivism. So we went from 54% of people who went to jail or prison before the reforms recidivating within 2 years, people who were equivalent but went to treatment after the reforms, 36%. So a reduction in recidivism. However, the reforms didn't reduce the use of prison or jail overall. Many of those who were diverted were sent to residential treatment, which in New York State basically is therapeutic communities, some of the places that Jason wrote about in his article. And people went there for long periods. So the average length of stay was 16 months. In a residential community. And many of those people who went to therapeutic communities self-reported their main drug of use as marijuana. Self-reported, so if you speak to the prosecutors will say, well, that's just because they want an easy ride, so they're just saying that marijuana is their main drug of choice. We weren't able to assess that, but certainly we think that there are people who really don't need therapeutic communities who are being diverted to this kind of treatment. And as a result, the drug law reform was expensive. For when we compared people who were sent to jail and prison before the laws changed with people who went to treatment after the laws, it cost $13,000 more to send someone to treatment after the laws changed than when you compared them to the criminal justice kind of equivalent. And also, we reported that the courts don't allow people to graduate from treatment if they're using methadone, buprenorphine, or other kind of medically assisted treatment. So again, a big barrier to people who use opiates and need these kind of medications in order to remain stable. So some of the limitations and observations of this work for the use of drug courts elsewhere. We compared treatment to a punitive sentence when we did this work. So when I talk about reductions in recidivism, we're comparing going to prison or jail with receiving treatment. We're not comparing receiving treatment in the criminal justice system with receiving treatment in the community. And we're not comparing receiving treatment with and just being left alone and not going to treatment. Or so, and I think that's an important feature. And we didn't test whether the court mandate actually meant that people were more likely to succeed in treatment. Also, in the study we did, we didn't randomly assign people to receive treatment or not to receive treatment. So there's, you know, we could have a conversation about the methodological limitations of doing that. I'm confident that our study was fairly robust in methods, but still, you know, it was not a perfect randomized controlled trial, which, you know, is the gold standard for this kind of work. And so thinking about our findings, I mean, in terms of New York City, there were some promising findings, but a long way to go. But if other countries or other settings are thinking about learning from New York City's experience, Denise mentioned this, New York City was starting from a very low point, from people serving long sentences for drug felony charges, people not having access to treatment in the community when they were, and only being able to get services in the criminal justice system. So for New York City, it might have been a step forward. For many places that don't have such a racially biased and punitive criminal justice system, adopting these changes might well be a step backwards. And I think that's just an important point to note when you think about what other countries can learn about the drug court experience in the US. There's no other country which is as punitive as the US, as we know, in terms of use of incarceration. So the US is, we are far to the end of the scale. And also, we found that it's expensive. So for people who went to these therapeutic communities, to residential treatment, it costs $34,000 to send someone to that treatment for the 16-plus months. So we didn't raise the question about what could you do with $34,000 if you were to use it differently in terms of helping people succeed. I have some recommendations for what our findings say about how you would think about implementing drug courts or improving drug courts, which I can go over, but I'll leave those to see if there are any questions, I think, and pass to the next person.
Sounds good. Next, we're going to hear from Elaine Pawlowski. She lists her bio as mother and educator, and while that sums it up nicely, I'd be remiss not to point out that she has been a vigorous and necessary voice to push for more careful interrogation of the role of drug courts in medical matters. The need and indeed propriety of having judges overrule doctors, and the evidence that gets trotted out in support of drug courts and the measures that we use to declare drug courts as a successful intervention. She has been a strong supporter of measures like California's Prop 47, which eliminate the use of drug courts for nonviolent drug offenders. And I would like her to tell us a little bit more about how she got there and her experiences with drug courts.
Hi, my name is Lane Kowalski. I'm a retired educator, actually, here from New York. I'm a mother in January. I'm a first-time grandmother. But on July 4th, 2012, my middle son was found dead in his New York City East Side apartment. He was 29 years old. He was a vibrant, well-educated working professional here in New York City, and he was being treated by his own physicians for substance issues. He recognized that he needed care, and he was getting the professional help from his own doctors here, and he was doing very well, but he made a mistake. We know much of the dilemma that he had on that last day, and we know he was in a crisis situation. We know that he could not present himself to the emergency room without breaking his probation. We know that the 911 New York Good Samaritan law wouldn't have protected him either, because he was involved with the drug treatment court north of the city here. On the day he died, he didn't go to the hospital, as he always did. He didn't call 911, and neither did anyone that he may have been with. We don't know. He passed away in his home in Manhattan, even though he lived one block from Lenox Hill Hospital, and that's where his doctors were. Why didn't he call 911? In 2010, my son's lawyers recommended that he be placed in New York drug treatment court for a driving alcohol violation. This would change our lives forever. I've experienced a New York drug court as a supportive mom and have learned more since 2010 than I care to know about the stigma that substance use has on the courts, on drug policy, on journalism, as well as advocacy. We didn't feel shame that my son was addressing his misuse of substances. We supported his efforts and we openly talked about his life. Drug treatment court and probation set a new level of horror that we had never witnessed before. It's the dirty secret that many families keep to themselves. Not only are participants berated and shamed in public forum, but family members are publicly humiliated and demeaned for the support of their own child, their partner, or spouse. At times, it is not only the participant that is under the drug treatment court supervision, but the families as well. Private medical information is aired in public, family shortcomings as well as romantic relationships and breakups are discussed. Hearsay or gossip is treated as truth. Sitting in court, I learned more about each of those participants' personal lives than I knew about any of my friends. Judges and district attorneys take on a reality show demeanor that the public views as acceptable. In fact, the National Association of Drug Court Professionals' opening webpage has a link to NBC's Dateline, which follows Scary Mary, the tough-talking judge of the Michigan Drug Court. When a so-called news investigations highlight this type of scare tactics as normal and acceptable, we need to ask ourselves what has happened to our society to allow this behavior from our court officials. The court antics and atmosphere destroy all trust in the process. This cannot be a standard of what they call as an innovative court. But we allow this tough love behavior because society also views those with substance issues with contempt. We stigmatize them as unworthy criminals and deserve what they get. We believe that they should be more than thankful to participate in drug treatment court and remain abstinents. They should not question, they should just obey. In order to graduate, an abstinence-only philosophy is imposed on each individual in drug treatment court, even those who are not substance use issues. Participants may have been arrested for marijuana, like many of them said here, or other substances under the New York punitive drug laws, and in lieu of prison, they are also receiving forced medical care that is not needed in order to stay out of the prison system. According to the National Institute of Health Outcome Trajectory Study, one-third is estimated that are placed in drug courts do not have issues with drug or alcohol abuse, yet they're receiving mandatory treatment. These individuals are accepted into programs and may be used to boost the success rates while others are denied. If state-approved programs did not rely on the court system feeder program to stay afloat, these unused beds would be available for those that really need care, which is basically mirroring what many of them have said. Once my son entered the drug treatment court program, he had no control over his medical care. His doctors at that time wrote letters to the court about what they recommended for his treatment. It was all ignored. Not only was his physician's treatment plan ignored, but so too was the drug treatment team's recommendations ignored. The lawyer at that time laughed at what her own team recommended. Since the judge agreed, my son was remanded to prison until they could find a place that they could both agree upon. Granted, the lawyers and the judges have no medical degrees, yet they chose to ignore a respected physician's treatment plan, their own team's recommendations, and instead sent my son to prison until they could find a program that would work for the two of them. Why did this happen? I have yet to find out. After my son's death, I've petitioned for all the treatment notes, discussions, transcripts, procedures, and court documents. I have yet to receive any of the treatment notes. Drug treatment courts operate behind closed doors. Judges, lawyers, and poorly educated counselors make medical decisions without any medical degrees. It is becoming modern common practice for medical drug companies to solicit drug courts judges with new medications, as some of the treatments have changed, and some of them are allowing certain medications. But yet the judges have no medical training to understand the rhetoric. Furthermore, doctors are liable for the medical decisions they make. Judges and drug treatment court members are not. They're left to practice medicine without any liability. The drug treatment court contracts that are signed by participants are legally questionable and are not updated with medical standards of care or reviewed by experts for the participants' protection. When bringing my son's signed contracts to two respected New York attorneys, the response was similar, and I quote, "The defendant must accept the most severe authorized sentence, a state prison sentence, and then put himself at the utter mercy of these people for many years. He must waive the right to counsel, the right to attorney, client confidentiality, all rights to privacy, the right to seek bail on a new arrest and to oppose extradition, and the right to oppose a probation violation on the basis of mere hearsay, and he must even accept indefinite and ill-defined obligations, such as to promote this program indefinitely. Participants have to make an agonizing decision to accept this program as an alternative to having their case adjudicated in the usual way, and the risks that he would have received a conviction or jail or prison time. Many of these agonizing decisions are simply money related, and I would say that my son's probably was too. It costs money to go to court to defend yourself, and a plea is expected. Getting your day in court is no more. It's just not common practice anymore. The show in the public drug treatment courtment is just that. It's a show. The teams are held accountable for the are not held accountable for the legality of their contracts or their treatment recommendations. They are not held accountable for their mistakes. They're not held accountable for the injuries or deaths under their watch. Neither are the injuries or death counts regularly recorded. You can't find them. Each drug court operates so differently that in the over 20 years of the expanding drug courts, we really have no idea how many individuals and families have been hurt or what due process rights have been broken. The data just isn't kept. Furthermore, participants of drug treatment court are placed on probation and do not have the same rights as others when it comes to getting emergency care for drugs or alcohol. New York's 911 Good Samaritan law, designed to save lives by encouraging people to call 911 during an overdose, doesn't offer those on probation and in drug courts the same protection as others, even though drug courts say that drug abuse can be a chronic and relapsing condition. They and their families are left to fear arrest, fend for themselves, and risk death from overdose. For me, this is completely discriminatory and a state crime, but that's a personal opinion. The U.S. government has marked substance abuse as an illness in need of medical support and promotes drug treatment court as the compassionate answer to illegal substance use. In actuality, it continues to treat these individuals as morally defective and in need of behavior modification. Judges and lawyers are left to devise forced abstinent treatment that does not meet standards of care and are allowed to order participants into their own biased programs. Although there may be a recommended practice booklet for drug treatment courts, drug courts are not evaluated regularly to demand that procedures are followed or that education of team members are up to date. There's no oversight of any of these medical recommendations. The National Association of Drug Court Professionals continues to parade celebrities in support of their programs, and I have just wondered if these celebrities do not have the choice to refuse, as they too may be still under obligations from their own drug treatment court contracts. Judges are left to do as they please as the public relation teams mislead the public, sensationalize the process, and sugarcoat the details with catchy phrases in public service announcements. Nowhere do they present an expert example of what should happen into the day-to-day proceedings of the drug court. My son may be alive today if he did what he always did. He was taught to call 911 just like every kid. But because of the punitive drug laws and the stipulation of drug treatment court, he hesitated and questioned whether it was worth it. A call was not made, and neither did he walk the one block to the hospital. He died like others here in New York alone. Furthermore, the police assumed he was yet another investment banker that partied way too much. Although the police had many questions, they just waited for the toxicology reports and no real investigation has been done. My son is home now. He's on the 29th step of the Morris Island Lighthouse in South Carolina. And I continue to support the restoration of the lighthouse in the memory of my son. But there's no mother should have to go through this. There's 2,500 drug court programs operating in the United States, and they're trying to get them, more of them, and spread it across the world, the globe. We need to hold the judges responsible for the medical decisions made under their watch, and we need to hold drug treatment courts accountable for what they profess to do. We also need to expand the 911 Good Samaritan laws to protect all of those that may be dying, not just select groups. And no one should fear punishment for calling 911 if they are in a desperate situation. I have also been actually allowed to, I don't know why they print them, but I do write a few blogs for the Huffington Post, and I've been researching this since my son has passed away. Thank you.
It's a really important perspective and experience, and one that I unfortunately have not heard as often when these drug courts are discussed. Usually what you get are these before and after evaluations where people come out and they don't have an addiction problem and they say, well, look, they don't have an addiction problem. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, if you give me treatment for prostate cancer, I am in the end not going to have prostate cancer. But it's these before and after evaluations that get pushed and supported as evidence that they work, what you hear constantly. So I thank you for coming and sharing your experience, because we need to hear more about what the other side is. And I'm going to give each speaker a chance to react to each other's presentations, and then we're going to take some questions from the audience. Thank you.
I just had a question for Lane. When your son was before the drug court, what did his doctor recommend that they laughed at? I'm just curious as to what, because that seemed interesting.
He had a... doctors here. Oh, I'm sorry. He had doctors here that recommended a certain facility, and they felt, or he felt, it was, you know, the best place for him. It was quite a high-priced facility. The public defender, but the attorney, you know, looked at it and thought, Here's a rich kid. He's going to a rich program. That's not acceptable. It's the same thing as the treatment court professionals. They had recommended a place, and I don't know why they didn't take at least the drug court treatment team's advice. That, like, floored me. And I've yet to find that out. I've petitioned to have all my son's records from the court, and our attorneys and myself have been jumping from one hoop to another, and they haven't released much of that information. Some of the information that I do have is not complete. They've pulled a lot of records that I know happened because I was there. So we're just still in a process, so a lot of those questions I can't even answer because I don't know what they were thinking. And nobody does, because that type of discussions are left in closed doors, and it's behind the scenes. And there's no openness about how they make these decisions.
So when I visited some of these specialty courts, one of the things that they said about not having strict requirements about what records they keep or where they send people is that the flexibility is part of what makes it great. That the regular justice system runs people through like a mill, but the specialty courts can really take care of people. So it's important to hear your story and to hear examples of, as Jason was saying, of people not really being individualized in treatment, because the reality is that it isn't a very personalized approach. It's flexible in the sense that every court can do something different, but not necessarily individualized, which is what I think some people need. Can you reflect on that, Jason?
Yeah, I can. Actually, as the heroin epidemic hit Kentucky, they actually lost bed space. So they were losing capacity to even treat kids in any of their treatment facilities. But one thing was interesting was, as the epidemic was hitting, the Department of Corrections and through the courts, they signed up these contracts with different facilities. So in one of the main facilities in Northern Kentucky, they had more than 50% of the beds. And they decided about like a year ago, just randomly almost, that they were only going to pay for a certain amount of days. And so they cut the amount of time that a person can be in their treatment under the court supervision by, I think it was 90 days. So instead of having like an extended period of time to get treatment or to whatever, they just sort of mandated that you're going to get one-third of your time was going to be reduced. And that was across the board. I don't think that was made because a doctor said it was the better way. I think it was a cost-cutting measure. And so a lot of the times, I think a lot of the motivation really comes from, actually, how much is this going to cost? I think in your case it was. And when I've seen Medicaid or other sort of medical professionals talk about it, they only talk about, say, the medication, this is the MAT treatment, in terms of how much it costs. Suboxone does cost a lot of money. In the facilities that the drug court favors, their big selling point is that they're super cheap. That's like, you know, on their website, they will say, you know, we only cost like 35 cents a day, and you know, we are super cheap and affordable, and that's sort of the main selling point. Never mind the actual care.
If I can add to that, if you have insurance, they make you use your insurance. And if they recommend a place and you don't have the insurance or it costs more, the family members have to pay for it. So where they ended up sending my son, his insurance had worked to a certain point, and they also agreed that it was not necessary for what the court was going to recommend. But since I didn't want him to sit in jail, I ended up paying for the treatment that they recommended just so he could get out of jail. So it works both ways. They want to get money for the specific facilities that they have on their list, and they will use the person's insurance first to cover it, and then if the judge deems that you haven't jumped through enough hoops, somebody else has to come along and pay for it, and it's usually a family member. Or they sit in jail until there's an opening for them to return because the judge has mandated that.
Rick, I'm wondering if you can reflect on Jason's comment about the public defenders feeling beaten down in Kentucky. What has been your experience seeing public defenders having to deal with this system? How much do they feel like they can do in this context? And how do they feel about this court and working in them?
Sure. I just a couple of thoughts. I forgot to talk. You know, it baffles me that other places around the world have any interest in exporting parts of our criminal justice system. It really baffles me. I was part of a United Nations delegation last year. I went to Ghana and to Liberia, and I got to spend 10 days with their 24 public defenders operating in the entire country of Liberia. And I think this was the first time that they all came together in one place, and we got to take a real sort of hard, close look at how the criminal justice system works in Liberia. And one of the things that I walked away from that experience, understanding, is that you have to have respect for the places that you go, because there are lots of things that they do better than we do, and there are lots of things that they do in Monrovia and in other parts of Liberia that are more enlightened in terms of dealing with people and issues and criminal justice issues and what should be and should not be in the criminal justice system and how you handle that stuff. So the thought that places are, and I agreed just last week to go to Kathmandu later this year to do a similar kind of thing, but I'm going there wiser, understanding that there are lots of things that people do in their homelands, in their native countries, that are much more enlightened than the things that we do here. And certainly I would not want to be an exporter of problem-solving courts and drug courts to other countries, because I think that there are much more effective and meaningful impactful ways to deal with these kinds of social and human issues. The other thing that you said that I had not thought about, but it's true, and it sort of ties in with the question you asked me about public defenders, is that the concept in these problem-solving courts, the concept in these drug courts, is one of a team sort of concept, that the prosecutor and the defense attorney and the judge and the social workers and all the treatment folks are all part of the same team. And sort of the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendment sort of fly out of the window. This idea of zealous advocacy is sort of gone, and everyone's supposed to be sort of on the same team. The client, the defendant, will stand up frequently in open court and talk directly to the judge, and the defense lawyer has either bought into this in many parts of the country or feels constrained to stop it. And so I think that, and to the extent that in these team meetings, they are dealing with people who have public health issues, and they are dealing with people who have substance abuse issues, and who need good medical guidance. You know, it's an interesting idea that I suspect it would cast a different pall on these courts if there really was some accountability, if there really was some idea that a judge could find himself smack dab in the middle of a medical malpractice suit because he had not done, you know, what was provident from a medical perspective, having no medical sense whatsoever. I bet you if there were that kind of liability, and there is not, but if there were that kind of liability, I bet you it would change a little bit the way that people think about these courts. And you're right, from the defense perspective, it is a sort of a neutering experience. It really is an experience where the ability to be a zealous advocate, the ability to, and the private bar is almost non-existent in these courts. So the ability to really stand up and represent your client in a meaningful way, in an adversarial way, which is what our justice system is really all about and ought to be about, and we ought to be limiting it to those kinds of, I mean, when you start to bring all society's problems to the criminal justice system, this is what you get. And so that's why defense attorneys find themselves oftentimes standing mute while clients are saying all kinds of incriminating things to a court, and decisions are being made in back rooms by a team where they're not many times in the best interest of that individual.
I'd just like to pick up on the issue of public defense as well. We're doing some work on how public defenders negotiate conversations with clients who have serious mental illness. So a different population, but still a population that has a public, basically a health need. And what we're finding is that whereas some defense services, such as the Harlem Neighborhood Defenders or the Bronx Defenders or other agencies, may have access to social workers or clinicians, most public defenders don't have the qualifications or the ability to make decisions about what treatment needs their clients have either. So saying you need zealous public defense when you're dealing with what is primarily a treatment issue, yes, you do need zealous public defense, but neither the prosecutors, the defenders, or the judges are qualified to make decisions about whether their client has a treatment need, if their client does have a treatment need, what services they need, require, and then also whether it's a good idea. I mean, we talked to a number of public defenders who are conflicted about when they should raise these kind of issues of people's public health needs in court because of a concern about what will happen to their clients if they get caught up in something like a drug court or a mental health court when they may be facing a fairly minor charge. So I think that defenders are often conflicted. They don't want to raise these issues. They don't know what will happen because it may mean that their clients get further sucked into the criminal justice system, where often I think the approach is just kind of keep your head down, we'll get you out of the court. You won't get treatment, so you know it may mean that you're back here on another drug offence in a year's time, but let's just like not get you caught up in what can be a very deep entanglement in the court system if you end up going to a drug court and you get revoked and you end up in prison. So I think public defence is, of course, essential for people in the justice system. Good public defence is essential. But it's not a substitute for somebody who has clinical experience who can determine what someone's treatment needs are.
And I would say that there is not a doctor on any of these courts that are advising them. There may be a counselor. They may have 6 weeks of counseling in drug addiction. And when they're talking about how much it costs to run those courts, if you're going to AA, which doesn't cost anything, and the judges are recommending AA, they don't have to worry about the cost. If there's not a doctor on call charging his fees, there's going to be no cost if they don't have them there. If that was part of the process, those fees would go up. And like Jason said, they're going to cut because it costs too much money. If they had to put a doctor on all of these courts, they would not be able to run these courts. It would be just too much money. I did want to add to your comment about lawsuits. In 2014, Clark, Indiana has a class action suit pending for a judge in Clark County. And it's a class action for too much jail time because, like Jason said and others said, and my son was sitting in jail for a certain amount of time. The lawyer also for my son, he recommended not to prosecute that, you know, because I could have gone and said, you have my son in jail for too long, and because he didn't want to interfere with the judge. Because so much is done by the judge. If you're not on the good side of the judge, he can just, for any reason, put you in jail. So that's part of the problem as well. There's just no accountability anywhere in these courts.
I'm going to turn it over to the public now. If anybody has any questions, please walk over to the microphone so that we can record. We're recording the session. Thank you so much.
My name is Joanne Chetta. Thank you very much to everyone on the panel for those excellent presentations. I just wanted to say more in the guise of comment than question. In response to this question of why is it that any country would be interested in exporting or importing this model? Well, if you could hear the way that the United States represents it in UN meetings and in other international fora, you wouldn't ask that question, because this is now, very consciously on the part of the administration, the magic third way between lock 'em up prohibitionism and crazy legalization on the other side. And drug courts are spoken of as the true solution, and there are drug court judges who are trotted out to these international meetings, and drug court judges from outside the U.S. from countries that are allied to the U.S. who are telling stories about drug courts that, again, as Denise suggested, give before and after beautiful stories of lives transformed. So part of the context I think that we should be aware of for this discussion is that next year here in New York, at a special session of the UN General Assembly, there will be a major moment for reflecting on the global drug regime. And the United States will come to that meeting, and US allies will come to that meeting, with drug courts as a major new avenue for global drug control. And so as you have a chance in all of your lines of work, there will be a lot of journalists, there will be a lot of attention to this meeting to speak on this. Please, please, please bring the evidence, because the evidence is being completely distorted.
Thank you, John.
Can I just say about that? That was, you know, it reminds me, this is a few years ago now, I was on a panel somewhat similar to this talking about this issue. And there was a judge from a drug court who was on the panel with me, and one of the success stories from the drug court. And it was a woman. She was probably in her late 30s, early 40s. She was a mother, and she told a very compelling story about how at a very young age, 12, 13 or so, she got involved with drugs, and it got increasingly worse, and all of the horrible things that it led to, and all the different ways and reasons and why she'd been arrested and the horrors of her life, and how and she had this long rap sheet of, you know, all kinds of different all kinds of different convictions, and finally she landed in drug court and it changed her life, and because of drug court she was now back with her kids and had a job and was, you know, back on the road to wherever, and at the end of that. And at the end of her presentation, I asked the question, well, what would have happened if in society there had been a place for you when you were 12? Mm-hmm. You would probably have avoided all of the next 30 years of pain, right? And this is literally a true story. I was here and the judge was there, and the woman he brought was sitting there. By the time we finished the panel, the woman he brought was sitting next to me. She had realized that although she was in a good place now, had there been resources for her when she was 12 or 13 or 14 or 15, someone to listen to her and guide her in a different way in the public health resources, she would have avoided those 30 years of pain. And so I think that that's really sort of the classic example of how we deal with sort of this presentation that is made by drug courts and drug court judges.
And also, if I could say that, I've written to the American Medical Association as well, and they've called me back, and it's the same thing there. The medical professionals are not educated in this. So it's easier for them, and they promote the drug courts as well, because therefore they don't have to deal with the treatment issue at either. They don't even have licenses to be able to understand how to do a maintenance treatment. Or with drugs either, and they rather pass that off, and so they can't access treatment. And there is especially, not just for adults, if you look at it in the juvenile system, it's even worse. It's just even worse.
I mean, I would say that also, when you talk about PR efforts and that kind of thing, judges and the police, they know how to come across as empathetic. They know that, you know, the country is moving more towards legalization, or at least good drug reforms.
But decriminalization.
Decriminalization, that's a good word for it, sorry. And so the judges, no matter what, they'll say the same thing that more progressive side would say. Addiction is a disease, it's just like diabetes. But it hasn't, the rhetoric has not translated into a new system or an empathy towards defendants. They still viewed defendants the same way. I felt that they still had the same animosity towards them, even if they were in their courtroom. The presumption of guilt, looking at them, everything they do is a lie or with very harsh skepticism. They'll only say it's a disease. I mean, they'll say it to me, but they won't really put that into practice. And I'll say there was one, I don't want to dwell on this one point, but there was a facility in Baltimore that realized that it was a methadone clinic, and they were operating very punitively. You missed a day, you were gone. You ended up in jail, you were out of there, off their role, the roster. All these other rules, you talk back once, you're out of there. You know, all these different things. And they realized that they were saying it's a disease, but they were not acting as if it was. They were not treating their clients with respect as if they have a disease like any other disease. And they changed their policies, and their dropout rate actually, not surprisingly, decreased. They now have their attitude now is if somebody quits their program or leaves without completing it, that's their failure, not the addict's failure. And that was a change that they had made. They realized that they were talking a good game, but they weren't really practicing it.
Just a very quick point. I know we're all treating drug court research with a healthy dose of skepticism. The research which looks at the things which predict success, the most important predictor is the judge. So I think that while there may be some challenges and flaws that we've identified with the drug court model, I think that there is also a huge range in the application of drug courts. And I think often, I mean, prosecutors are the gatekeeper to drug courts, but the judges are the people who operate them and make decisions often about what happens to people in drug court and how it's operated. So I think that just bears out what you're saying.
Hi, thanks. My name is Daniel Wolf. I'm the director of the Harm Reduction Program in Public Health here, and I have a comment and a question. The comment is, though I work internationally, I guess I would add a note of caution about the idea that a doctor's presence will necessarily result in appropriate treatment, because there are so many instances when doctors share, as Elaine's last comment highlighted, some of the same biases and discomfort around what we mean by success in drug treatment. And as long as abstinence is taken as the only gauge, in fact, it's not an honest medical conversation. And there, of course, are doctors participating in many of the treatment facilities to which people are being referred. And this leads me to my question, which is, I know we focused on the criminal justice side. Obviously, there are also powerful vested interests in filling a bed for 18 months. In fact, in many places, corrections and drug courts are the only people who would pay at this point for such long-term treatment, and that's regardless of whether it's necessary or not, because in fact it's doing double duty as a place to sort of contain people. And I'm curious if any of you have looked at the role or scrutinized the role of the drug treatment providers. I would, and Jason, in your piece in the Huffington Post, you made an important distinction, which you didn't make here today, between AA and which is actually free and not a for-profit entity, and 12-step programs in the context of treatment providers, which obviously have a vested interest and a sort of revenue stream. So I'm curious about the role of the healthcare providers actually in perpetuating the system, and if anyone has looked at it. Thanks.
I just perhaps not directly addressing your question, but it's interesting that with changes in healthcare policy and the Affordable Care Act, now certainly there will need to be a justification made for medical necessity in order to get drug treatment services covered by the federal government. And I expect that this will have a massive impact on drug courts, because demonstrating that long periods in residential treatment are medically necessary is going to be difficult. And the insurance and the insurers, private insurers and the federal government, are going to push back hard against that. So it will be interesting to see how that kind of filters through the drug court system. And if your theory is correct, which I strongly suspect that it is in many cases, that there is a need to fill beds, I think that we'll see a big change in that, hopefully, over the next couple of years.
One reflection is that during my years visiting specialty courts, I noticed that I never heard a judge ask a participant if they liked their treatment, if their treatment provider was treating them well, how that was going. So I realized that there was kind of no quality control for what the treatment providers were doing. And I noticed that the worse the treatment providers were, as far as I could assess, the more they loved the court. Because you don't need to provide good services if the court is requiring people to be there. So there was never any incentive to have any kind of customer-oriented approach or, you know, person-oriented approach. People were required to be there, and it was great. The bad treatment providers loved the court. They loved the fact that they didn't have to do a thing, just tell people, I'll call your judge if you don't come. So there was a perverting effect that the courts were having on treatment providers, whereas some of them would perhaps have engaged in that process of reflection that you're talking about, and asking how can we keep people in by providing better services, by getting people to want to be in treatment. They just never had to look at that, and it created this weird disincentives to not be very good. So that's a reflection on how the court is actually having a very negative effect on what of the treatment that is available.
Sharon Stancliffe, Medical Director of the Harm Reduction Coalition. Daniel said a lot of what I wanted to say, but I thought it would be good to get a doc to get up and add on to it a little bit. Yes, there are doctors behind every one of these treatment and these programs, at least in New York State. They are asked to do things, they're asked to have Medicaid pay for it, and Medicaid has come around and said, no, you can't do that. I worked for an agency that had not residential but mandated people. And that was a huge struggle with the courts to say, no, this person doesn't need it, we're not going to give it. And then, you know, personally, I felt like I had to leave for a number of reasons, but one of which is, okay, so they're calling it disease, and we're going to treat this person, and if I don't do a good job, they're going to prison. That's really interesting, and I think you know, there's not really a great road in through like the American Society of Addiction Medicine, but physicians need to understand a little better what they're doing. And as an add-on, I was in Northern Kentucky yesterday. Wow.
I just want to get to a couple points that were raised. One, I think the treatment system, no one really talks about the quality of care. The debate and the discussion is always about bed space and money and funding. A lot of the funding, a lot of the way the places are, the way the system is set up is by, funding streams. So for example, in Kentucky, it's sort of, I always bring up Kentucky because I went there, but the major drug treatment system is these 14 facilities. They're not run out of the Department of Health, they're run out of the Department of Housing because they get money from HUD. So the guy in charge is a housing guy. He's pretty knowledgeable, and I don't want to slam him for that. He also is really tied with the governor's, the first lady. She serves on the board. And so I FOIA'd, their emails together, and they had quite a cozy relationship where she often asked him for medical opinions, which he was completely unqualified for, such as, what do you think of residential treatment for, kids with bipolar or depression? And, he's an adult who mainly works with adult addicts. He doesn't know anything about kids. But she asked him, or she'll ask, the list can go on and on. But so there's those kinds of relationships. There's not really a debate about what is good treatment versus bad. And the oversight over these facilities is negligible or straight up lies or just bad science. And I feel like with the cases of the judges, or say Northern Kentucky, they rely on what's in their community. And so what's in their community is like this outspoken abstinence guy, they're going to go to him because he goes to the meetings. They're not going to go to the doctor. And think about all the ways that they make it really hard for doctors to practice and to treat addicts. Doctors already don't want to do it. It's not taught in schools. And to even get a certificate to do Suboxone, you've got to be certified. And you have a patient limit. You're also under incredible scrutiny for doing it. So many doctors I talk to talk about the scrutiny, or the police show up at their door, the DEA if you're over a certain limit, or in one case, the police just park in front of the office all day, just sit there, just try to take down the license plate numbers of their clients. So I mean that we have this sort of weird system where we go after doctors, but we don't focus at all on the treatment facilities. I'll just leave you with this one thing, and I'll stop blabbering. But a lot of these facilities have what's on their wall, like a death wall, they call it. All the people that died having graduated from the facility. And this is not seen as, oh my God, we have to reevaluate how we operate. This is, they always see this as a lesson to the ones that are coming in. You better fly right or you could die. And it's not, they don't use these kids as an example of how they failed, but they see it as they failed this system and it's a warning to all the other kids. They don't view it. It's not as seen as, oh my God, we need a crisis of consciousness. It's a badge.
The other thing with that, Jason, is the institution may have that wall, but if they're in a drug court, the drug court doesn't have that wall. They don't even count them.
Good point.
So they are like non-existent because they expect the facility failed them or the person failed, but yet the court doesn't have to keep track of any of this. And neither do they have to keep track of anyone who may be injured in the treatment facilities, which I had written an article about some of these facilities. Even in the drug court that my son was at, a girl stood up and said how she was sexually assaulted and so on and so forth, and the judge looked away, and you know, I don't know if it went anywhere, but those things aren't recorded either.
Hello, I'm Kenneth Anderson from Hams Harm Reduction for Alcohol, and I wanted to make a couple comments. Well, rather than the AMA, you might want to contact the American Association of Addiction Psychiatrists, the AAAP, which seems to me pretty good. I just started checking them out recently. Some of our most popular treatments, the 12-step treatment programs, the last time they were analyzed with a controlled trial was 1980, and they did worse than the control group. So, I mean, the normal outcome of addiction is people get over it on their own. So saying, oh, look, people got better, that proves nothing. You got to get better than the control group. And also, in the majority of states in the United States, mandating 12-step programs has been ruled unconstitutional. It's a violation of the First Amendment, Freedom of Religion Clause, especially with the Ninth Circuit judgment that did all these states. So it's really not constitutional to send anyone to a 12-step program. And, well, those were the comments that I wanted to make. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Newman, and I want to absolutely agree with what has been said about the very, very negative role of a lot of physicians in connection with the drug courts. An observation, I think there's nothing that professionals, be they journalists or be they lawyers or doctors, can say with regard to drug courts and the adverse impact of drug courts that comes anywhere near being as compelling as the voice of somebody who has had family members go through it and personally suffered. Elaine is one case in point. A few months ago, there was a brief TV coverage of a drug court judge in Nassau County. It was either Nassau or Suffolk County. And it was a father who said his son had been doing very, very well. He had been on methadone, got his life together. He was caught up in some, I think, court case, a warrant, forced to go off of methadone, and the father found him dead in his bed just a few weeks later. Just one other really word of caution in terms of terminology. There have been several references to addiction, substance misuse being a public health problem. There are certainly public aspects of almost any kind of illness, whether it's diabetes or epilepsy or anything else. But the individual person who is being presented for treatment to healthcare providers, I feel has to be viewed as an individual patient with an individual problem. As soon as you say we're treating this person as a public, as an example, as an illustration of a public health problem, then you open the door to justifying anything and everything that's done by the prosecutors, by the judges, by the social workers who work with the courts, by the treatment providers who participate. Because they can say, hey, you know, sure, we're treating an individual, but our goal is to protect and help the public. And you can get away with almost anything if you say that, especially because ultimately we're looking to the public to support the views that have been expressed today about drug costs. So, sure, there are public health components, but we're talking about individuals with individual problems, and that's where they should be treated. Thanks.
I had a comment and a question. My name is Helen Redman. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and I've worked with drug users for a long time. And I'm also a journalist, and I write about different aspects of the war on drugs. And when I listened to all your remarks, I kept wondering, where is the drug user in all of this? It's what the judge wants. It's what the prosecutor wants. Everybody else except the person with the drug problem, that their voice is somehow not at all a part of this process, and that's a problem. Because people who use drugs, they actually know what they need, and to discount that voice is really problematic. The second thing is, it's evident that our drug treatment system is a disaster. It's an absolute disaster. It's full of people who want to punish drug users, who don't have much education or licensure, and we need a revolution in our drug treatment system, and to move away from abstinence to a more harm reduction approach, which understand that relapse is normal and natural. And so my question to those of you still here on the panel is, do we need to get rid of drug courts? Do we need to abolish them? And if you think we need to abolish them, what do we put in its place?
Go there.
Not me.
I'll go there. That is the issue. It's the stigma, and it's also the laws. You know, if you are caught with alcohol, it doesn't matter, it's against the law. If you're caught with marijuana, it doesn't matter, it's against the law. So what do you do with them? You have to put them somewhere, because the law says it's illegal. So everybody who is a drug user is basically a criminal. Whether they're caught or not is where they're labeled a criminal. So really, it is going through and changing the laws, the drug laws. Because what do you need the drug court for if it's all right to have marijuana? So that may change because the laws with marijuana are changing. So you don't have to go there. If you're a youngster and you're doing alcohol in high school, you're going to be in a big problem where most of the kids do alcohol in high school. They're just not caught. So it's really changing the whole philosophy of the society, and I just don't know how long that will take.
I mean, I think it's all been sort of touched on how the drug court is sort of an inadequate and potentially, in some cases, harmful substitute for a real drug treatment system, or a real system where, as Dr. Newman pointed out, people can be cared for as individuals. When I was doing my story, towards the end of it, a doctor and we were going through the story and hashing it out, and she had this idea, and she wanted me to talk about the differences in how methadone versus Suboxone versus whatever could be used for an individual who is suffering. She had said that methadone is really an effective treatment for you know, your most hardcore user, the one that's been using for the longest or that has the most struggles. And, you know, it just dawned on me, it's like, well, we don't really have that choice. It would be great if an addict could go to a doctor or a professional who understands medicine, because it's been raised that sometimes doctors don't really understand what they're talking about, and make a decision based on the science and based on their history. I don't think we're getting that at all. We're getting this other thing. And you brought up a great point, we don't hear from addicts that much. And the addicts that I interviewed in the different facilities, or I would in some cases, collect the writings of people that passed away or interviewed friends. And the thing that sometimes the parents would say, you know, they were lying all the time, or, you know, always looked at them, in a way, parents sort of adopt what we all do, which is like the 12 steps sort of cultural thing. It's all sort of part of our language now. You know, they didn't reach bottom, or I was enabling them, and all this other stuff. And, you know, some of the parents, like, took their car away, drove their kids everywhere. The kids still died. And so what I got a sense from reading their writings and from interviewing addicts is that they were all really scared. I was surprised by how many addicts that I had interviewed who had tried to kill themselves, who the addiction was so great, it was so painful on all different levels, that they had tried to overdose, had thought about overdosing, or just thought they eventually were going to kill themselves. That surprised me. No one that I had interviewed, very few that I interviewed, had great stories about what it was like to be a heroin addict. Like, this awesome time, me and my buddy shot up, and it was great. We sat around in my parents' basement. That was a story that someone told. That was the best of it. Most of it was like, I robbed someone's house, or I was desperate and I used somebody else to get drugs. Heroin is so cheap, it generally doesn't really require much. I got a sense from most people that they were really frustrated, and a lot of the addicts that had died had already knew that they were hitting a wall, that abstinence wasn't working, and they didn't know what to do because that's all they had, so they were hitting a wall and didn't know where to turn.
Just tying together that question a little bit with the comments from the doctor earlier about the issue of public health, and I think that actually it's a slight misinterpretation of public health when you say that it doesn't focus on the individual, because I think public health is a call to use the tools of epidemiology, the tools which public health as a field applies to epidemics, applies to disease, and to say we need to treat addiction as a public health issue. We need to understand that there are social determinants of health. It's to do with incarceration. It's to do with the kind of challenges that people face. We need to use those tools of medicine and public health to address this issue. That sidesteps the question about what do we need instead of drug courts, or do we need drug courts? Certainly in New York State, there was a concerted effort by many progressive organizations to overturn the Rockefeller drug laws. There wasn't the call to decriminalize drugs. Perhaps the call was a step towards that. It was reducing the harm of incarceration by overturning the drug laws as a first step. So I know that's perhaps a pragmatic response and perhaps a wrong-minded response, but going from a system which is extremely punitive to thinking about how you reduce the harms of excessive incarceration, I think many people see drug courts as being a step in the right direction. Well, obviously, maybe not enough of a step in the right direction, clearly, but I think that's often why people end up advocating for a drug court rather than prison.
And the other thing that no one's really investigated is if you're going to a drug court, you're signing contracts. So you're really, if there was a really big investigation on what these kids are signing or what the adults are signing, the contracts in and of themselves really need to be investigated, because that's where you get more of the going back to jail because you didn't follow the contract. Some of the contracts that I've seen, even out of Florida, part of it is dependent on where you live in the country. The stipulations are different. In Florida, one of the ones that I read, you have to go to church every week. It doesn't matter if you're Jewish, it doesn't matter what rationality you are, but you do have to go to church every week. And if that's not in there, you don't go. I don't remember. And in part of my son's contract, you can't use aftershave. You can't go to a restaurant. You can't, I mean, there's so many stipulations on that. And the other component of that is that if someone sees you there, they will call the judge or they will tell somebody, and, you know, it's brought up in court. My son's first day there, the judge said to him, I saw you in such a bar. And my son looked at him and like, no, I was at work. And he goes, well, you were at work at 10 o'clock at night? And he goes, well, I work in investment banking. I work 50 hours a week. I wasn't there. And he goes, well, I guess it wasn't you. But that's what goes on in those courts, is that anything that's being said or whatever's written in these contracts can come back.
I'm an attorney, but I've never practiced criminal law. And in fact, what I do is health policy. So this whole discussion is completely, you mentioned the Affordable Care Act, I mean, where health policy is going is completely in the opposite direction from this. So we're all working on the triple aim is to not just reduce costs, but really to focus on quality of care. And everything is becoming into accountable care organizations and managed care. And the idea of social determinants of health, that you have to look beyond like clinical practice of care to what are the social determinants of health, like housing and education and poverty and all these other things. So like I'm thinking like maybe the answer is somewhere in this reform that we're doing now of the healthcare system, and yes, to decriminalize and to try to really address this with this new health system that they're trying to create. I'm not that optimistic about it, and that's why I've been focusing most recently on quality of care measures and the idea that this other system is out there with absolutely no quality of care measures being imposed on it, because that's where the health care system is going. You are being required to prove quality and to, you know, outcomes. And, you know, it's just amazing to me that they're getting away with this. So, you know, whenever I have a chance, I'll try to bring up this other system out there.
Yes, do.
Thank you. I think if even a grain of that comes through, it will be much better than what we have right now.
Hi, I'm a social worker at the Public Defender's Office. And the topic of the judge who oversees the problem-solving courts was brought up. And since problem-solving courts have expanded to mental health and all sorts of other things, especially in New York, how do you recruit the right judge and the right ADA into these problem-solving courts so that maybe they're a little bit more empathetic, or maybe they protect clients' privacies or a lot of things that were brought up?
Wow, that's a tough one.
I mean, so I know in New York City, judges who work in the mental health courts, who I would say were exemplary in terms of their approach. I think often people self-select. People may self-select for the right reasons, or they may self-select for the wrong reasons, because they have a particular philosophy about treatment which they want to expand, whether that's the right philosophy or whether it's not. And you know, I think we've all read about a zealously religious judges who will have requirements which may not be to everyone's beliefs. So, I don't much more to offer than that.
I would say you want a judge who's pretty politically bulletproof, because you want a judge that can set their own measures of what success is, rather than have to play to the lowest common denominator of success, which is just like absolute abstinence for people who, you know, used to smoke pot on the weekends and then don't smoke anymore. So I don't know. I mean, that's really, I feel like in a sense it's a little bit rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic to talk about how to work with the right judge for a drug court. So it's a very difficult question to answer. Because in the end, what you want is an acknowledgement that people using drugs is not the worst thing that can happen. And the elephant in the room is just really the stigma that you referred to, and where are the drug user voices. And as long as we have a system and we live in a country where using drugs is considered just the absolute worst thing, worse than losing your civil rights, worse than losing your freedom, worse than losing your autonomy, worse than, you know, signing a contract where you can't go to a restaurant or use aftershave. I mean, it's really worse than shaming your family. Then we can't really have a good, positive drug court. I mean, it's just that drug court would not exist in a world where we would acknowledge that there are worse things that can happen to a person than using drugs, and that, in fact, drug courts do a lot of those worse things. So this is part of the conversation that we're having, perhaps opening people's eyes a little bit to what are the negative effects of these drug courts. And I do want to say, because I will be criticized for not saying it if I don't say it, that I understand that a lot of the individuals that work in drug courts have very good intentions, and they think that they're doing the right thing, and they're working in a very difficult system that puts the wrong incentives and the wrong measures on them, and they're trying to do their best. So I don't want to demonize the people who work in these drug courts, but it is a system that is fundamentally wrong for the ends that we want to achieve, and we do need to highlight the due process costs of these interventions, which have to do with civil rights and with diminishing our adversarial system of justice. And we do have to talk about the medical costs of these interventions, which also have to do with diminishing people's human rights and right to make their own medical decisions and right to the autonomy of their bodies. So on that note, I'm going to close it unless somebody else has something to that they want to ask publicly. Otherwise, you can just come approach us and we can chat a little more, drink some wine, have some food. Thank you all so much for coming here and helping us be part of this conversation.